Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. It is 9:14 on your Wednesday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. It's time for the Roundtable panel, and our panel today, Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith, SUNY New Paltz communications professor, former New York State Senator Terry Gibson, and communications consultant Joe Bonilla. You are always invited to join us here on the panel by emailing us panel@wamc.org. Try to keep the letters brief. Make it one good, real good punch, and then call it a day. Don't include links. We can't click them on the air. Don't use abbreviations. Proofread if you can. And one email per customer per day. The email address is panel@wamc.org. Terry Gibson, welcome back to the show. You were here early today.
I was. I had to study up for the show. And
Are you prepared?
I'm prepared, and I also want to miss those school buses. I learned to come early, and you miss the school buses.
I got here at 10 of 7 for just that reason.
Look at that. Happy to be here.
Jen Smith, how are you?
Good morning. I am well.
You're in a good mood?
Wonderful. I am.
We'll change that. We'll do what we can.
I dare you.
Oh, I like that. The gauntlet is thrown. Joe Bonilla, the Bugattis man.
Hey.
So you tweeted out a picture of two of the most amazing looking cars a couple of weeks ago now?
About 2 weeks ago, yeah.
Tell me about the Bugattis.
Absolutely. So we had the International Bugatti Rally up in Saratoga Springs last week, a couple of weeks ago. It was the first time this event had taken place in the United States in 10 years. First time ever in New York State. And the highlight is we had these two Type 57 SC Atlantiques. There's only three left in the world, two that we know of. Each vehicle is worth about $50 to $60 million a pop.
Wow. And what was it like to drive them?
Well, I couldn't drive one.
What do you mean?
I wasn't able to drive one of
them.
Did
anybody drive them?
Yes, somebody did. So actually, one of the owners drove one of them. The other one was a little bit too busy. The other owner was Ralph Lauren. So he was not able to drive his vehicle, but it was such a sight to see. You see those upper mid-century pre-war Atlantiques, and then you see the newer Bugattis that people love as well. So it was quite the sight to see right down Broadway in Saratoga Springs for our parade.
It has to be tough to get parts for those nowadays.
A little bit.
You don't just drive into Midas, hey, I need a new muffler.
You're not going to your normal place for that. I mean, it's something where it's such a hobby, it's such a collector society with that, and we had 88 of them at one given time, so you had all these people, and they're part of this American Bugatti Club, and they communicate with each other, they love the brand, but they love, obviously, the hobby.
Following you on Twitter, I can tell you're a car guy.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so, have you had a look at my 2005 Town & Country out in the parking lot?
The Town & Country is
it's a little rusty, but
that's called distinguished marks. There you go.
Exactly. Owned by a semi-radio professional here. Before we start the panel today, I just want to remind you the lockbox is open. And our fund drive is in. I was going to ask the panel, what is the second Monday in October? Is it the 13th, the 14th? Does anybody have a calendar? I'm not sure when the fund drive actually begins. It's somewhere around the 13th or 14th of October. The 15th.
The 15th. I'm told.
Okay,
there we
October
go.
15th is the fund drive. And what we do is we have a lockbox, and people pitch in online, or they can call in at 800-323-9262, I think, and make a pledge. What we do is we shorten the fund drive. And somebody wrote in the other day, and I get it. He said, it's not really shortening the fund drive if you talk about it every day. But I beg to differ to some extent. The fund drives, if anyone remembers, back in the day, like 2 years ago, fund drive would be 7, 8, 10 days of nonstop fundraising.
True.
Now it's a day. It's 2 days, and it's done because we discuss this now, and people do the right thing and get in online at WAMC.org and make a pledge. Well, we have a special inducement, if you will. It is a WAMC exclusive. It is Capital Steps, and this is at the Egg in Albany, Friday, November 9th at 7:30 p.m., and a CD recording of the show. For a pledge of $150, you get a pair of tickets. This is a WAMC exclusive. A single ticket would be a $100 pledge. And, of course, if you want to pledge more than that, feel free. WAMC.org, the Capital Steps, funny, funny, funny. They'll be doing selections from their new album, Make America Grin Again, featuring, right?
That's a funny title.
Stormy Daniels, Suture Yourself. A lot of good stuff on that one, and we invite you to join us for that November 9th, 7:30 at the Egg, a $150 pledge. The lockbox is open at wamc.org. Now down to business. Kavanaugh's accuser wants FBI to investigate before hearing. Christine Blasey Ford wants the FBI to investigate her allegation that she was sexually assaulted by Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh before she testifies at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing next week, her lawyer said in a letter to the panel. The development came after President Trump showed sympathy for the embattled nominee, and the Democrats and Republicans are fighting over who should be on the witness list for this. I heard this morning the Republicans say the FBI investigation, if it happens, is completely separate from this. We want you to testify Monday, and there's some question about whether Blasey Ford will in fact testify. Who wants first?
Oh, gosh. I think right now a lot of what you're seeing is just I guess there's three components. I think you have the team Kavanaugh that's putting their case together, Blasey Ford. You've got the public now involved with letters attesting to character on either side. You know, it gets to the heart of two pretty prominent families from that region, because you're going back a span of 30 years. So how this is affecting them, the town, who else is going to step up and talk on behalf? And then you have the heart of the matter, too, which is you've got this timeline for the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and confirmation, rather. And then you have just the basic issue, which I think was brought up again by Rachel Maddow the other night, about due process and due process for both Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh, and how will that play out. So I think those are the things to watch. Whether we will see her step forward on Monday is to be determined. I think one of the what's being argued by her lawyers is, at least that's outstanding to me, is that they're asking for the investigation from the FBI, which, again, it is questionable whether that will matter. I don't think it'll affect the Kavanaugh confirmation much, and I don't know how much can actually be used in a case this old, and that just goes to different statutes of limitations. So,
well, I think you have to understand that the risk that this professor has taken by putting her name out there, I mean, just imagine what it's done to her family and herself. And you have to consider the fact that would she have done all of this and put herself in this position if what she had to say wasn't actually true and credible? Why else would she put herself through this? And I think that it's a reasonable request to ask that the FBI do an investigation, whether it's been done before, whether it's something that should have been in the past. I think putting her up there with this testimony without some type of legal investigation behind it is dangerous in terms of being able to make a credible case, and it makes it easier for the Republicans to push it aside, which I think is the whole point of what they're trying to avoid doing. Mm-hmm. And I also just want to point out that having served in a legislative body myself and both a local level and a state level, this case really does demonstrate the power of the majority. And I think unless you've really been there, you don't realize how much power the majority party has. The Republicans are in the majority. They control this process. And they have overwhelming power to move this through if they should choose to do it. And it'll be interesting to see just how far they're willing to push that power.
Well, I think this also speaks to the partisanship that we're seeing right now for any judicial nomination, whether at the federal level or even the state level. And, you know, most certainly right now, you know, we were looking at this when Kavanaugh was originally nominated. What would the Democrats have in their arsenal in terms of trying to at least delay or get Kavanaugh to withdraw? And this seems to be the one Hail Mary pass for the Democrats to actually be able to do this, whether or not this will actually result in a Kavanaugh withdrawal. As we saw with Harriet Myers in 05, and Bork was actually voted down. But the really key of this is if they can delay this to a point where it becomes more into the sphere of the midterm elections, can this be a rallying cry for Democrats this November?
So you think then, Joe, without putting words in your mouth, that this to some extent is a play for more votes in the midterms?
I don't think necessarily it's directly that, but it certainly is an indirect effect of that. And I think this also shows the potential that what Chuck Schumer could actually do. I mean, as the minority leader, he doesn't really have a lot of power to actually be able to push back on these nominations. And I think to Terry's point about the power of the majority, this is one of the only few ideas or at least concepts of that the Democratic minority can actually do right now.
But I also think that if you look at how this process has unfolded, I'm not convinced that everything that's happened here has been done purposely to benefit one side or the other. I think there have been possibly some strategic mistakes on the leaders of the Democratic side of the Senate that have been in control of this process. They obviously had this information much earlier.
In July, right here.
At least from me reading what I can get access to in the press, I do believe that it was kept very confidential and not shared with other members of the Senate, and that some of these senators are now just learning about it for the first time. And looking back on that, was that a mistake? I think maybe it could have been. When you're considering something as important as a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, you obviously want to respect the confidentiality of these individuals, but at the same time, knowing that this would be leaked out sooner or later, maybe better to deal with it on the front side.
Well, it wasn't really leaked, right? Feinstein said, I have this.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's kind of like more of a public disclosure of it, yeah, to a degree.
She tipped off that something existed, and then the press began to do their investigation.
Now, is there an ethical question here? In other words, if you have this information in July, and you wait until the hearings have gone, and we watched the hearings, and it was theater, and it was tedious for a long time. It was over and over the same questions. If you had this information, and you wanted to truly, for the sake of justice, derail a client or a nominee, don't you put that out there right away?
And I think that's an excellent question to ask, and I think that's something that's being examined. Again, you know, Senator Feinstein seems to. Be saying that it wasn't brought up because of a confidentiality agreement with Blasey Ford. And so, that also has to be taken into consideration of what agreements were there. Now, there is another factor of whether I think there was a comment about Feinstein saying that they were trying to have an outside investigation into what happened. And, I don't know if there are any local looks into this. I don't know if the representative who passed the information on to Feinstein had ever done anything else with that information that she had. So I think those are other questions to look at. And I think the troublesome thing, though, is the timeline of everything and the timing. And I think also the Senate's getting antsy of we've been pulling out this hearing for a long time. Do you completely delay it until, 2021? Or do you... just go through and appoint? Do you look at these things separately? Can that happen? These are things I'm not an expert in, and I can't say for sure whether you can make that confirmation and still have an investigation go on. And what would that, I think it would be bad precedent for the Supreme Court to have that going on simultaneously.
Well, let's not forget that this is the same Republican-controlled Senate that was able to avoid even having hearings for Merrick Garland, which is a pretty impressive feat just in terms of the maneuvering that they were able to do to avoid literally doing something that the Constitution says that we're supposed to do. So I think that they have the power to do pretty much anything that they want. The question is whether they will push it to the level of where it will jeopardize their own credibility and rub off on their ability to win seats in November.
And I think also it will... I think this applies some pressure and consideration to those members who can possibly confirm Kavanaugh one way or another. Those who are considered those swing.
So Senator Collins.
So, yep.
And a couple of others who are
Flake,
said to be on
even,
the fence.
Yeah. Those are all in question too, and that's when it reflects back on who they're representing and their constituency, and I think that's when that does come into play.
Well, do you think that possibly McConnell then waits to the lame duck midterm, right after November 6th, to actually push it through? Maybe saying right now, both him and Grassley, let's hold off for right now.
If he's still in control.
If he's still in control. But even despite that, you still have that window of about 2 months right there. Do you think that might possibly happen?
It is. And I think that's the interesting thing about this situation, these circumstances right now, is that there are at least a half a dozen different scenarios that could could play out feasibly and logically. And it's just, it comes down to sort of these individual decisions, right? Like, who decides to, you know, be the outspoken person, says like, no, we're going to push it through. Who's the outspoken people who say, no, they deserve due process. They deserve this hearing or this investigation, rather. And who wins?
Well, I think the Democrats have a pretty good case here. I think it's going to be difficult for the Republicans to push beyond the fact of, look, regardless of when it was supposed to happen, something has come out. It deserves to be treated seriously and deserves to be investigated. And that's what they're demanding.
And I think it also reflects back onto the Supreme Court, too, and what happened with the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill case.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Well, we will find out and we will get to your letters here. It's the roundtable. We have Terry Gibson here, Jen Smith and Joe Bonilla. You as well at panel@wamc.org. We will take a break for news and then get to some of those letters and move on here on the show. You're listening to the roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Wednesday morning, 9:34. Ray Graff with you, in for Joe Donahue just for today. Don't worry, he'll be back tomorrow. The panel is a good one today. Jen Smith of the Berkshire Eagle. We have SUNY New Paltz communications professor, former New York State Senator Terry Gibson, and communications consultant Joe Bonilla with us. You, of course, can join the fun, if you call it that, by emailing us panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And by the way, panel, you know, Alan Chartok not here today, celebrating the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
You show great reverence. Not even sitting in his chair. There's an empty chair where Alan once sat.
The light is ever so lightly lowered.
Yes.
I asked each and every one of you, I said, would you like to sit over there today? No. That's Alan's chair. So Alan's empty chair joins us as well. This email came in from Bernie. The accusations against Kavanaugh are serious, no doubt. Does this mean that if he's not nominated to the Supreme Court, he simply goes back to being a judge, no harm, no foul? I know this is past the statute of limitations, but what are the repercussions for him after this?
Well, he would go back to what he's doing right now, but the issue that we were talking about during the break is that if he withdraws his nomination, or let's say he gets to a vote and he gets knocked out, will the president then nominate a further hardliner conservative to the court?
Mm-hmm. Well, also, if he drops out without any further investigation on this, then this issue is kind of dead and doesn't go any further, and he can resume his life. But his credibility and his life in general has really been damaged regardless of what happens here.
Mm. This one came in from Mary. Dr. Blasey is understandably terrified both of some members of the public and of the old white men in the Senate. She and her family have had to move out of their home due to death threats. Senators are already parroting their predecessors in 91, who dragged Anita Hill through the muck, forever altering the course of her life. Only a background investigation could add to what Dr. Blasey has already said. But Senator Grassley says he sees no reason to delay the Kavanaugh hearings.
Well, I read in her attorney's letter, obviously, that the death threats and obviously the challenge that her family's facing right now, and you know, certainly for her to have the courage. And again, this is something where you take on a national role not by your own design, and that's tough. You know, we deal with that on the communication side all the time, where we have individuals that don't want to be thrust into the public light, but they have to be, you know, for the greater good. And I think her story is very important. But nonetheless, it's a tragedy on all fronts.
This one is from Russ in Greenfield, Massachusetts. If Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge were as drunk as Christine Blasey Ford has said, isn't it possible that both Kavanaugh and Judge don't remember the event because they were so drunk at the time? Many years ago, in my younger days, there was an occasion or two that I got so drunk that I didn't remember what happened afterwards, and I had to rely on my friends to tell me what happened after the fact. Why has this not been brought up as a distinct possibility? That is from Russ in Greenfield, Massachusetts.
Because that's not an excuse.
Yeah. you know, I think it also has been brought up about, you know, what happens. I think the drinking aspect has been brought up quite a bit in this case about and that's what complicates this, any potential investigation, is that it's harder to find kind of evidence when you have a room full of drunken potential witnesses,
including the alleged victim.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously doesn't remember some aspects, how she got to the party and things like that. It was 35 years ago. So the whole thing may or may not begin to play out on Monday. We'll find out. Let's see here.
But you also look at what Kavanaugh just said a few years ago, you know, what happens at Georgetown Prep
stays at
Georgetown
Prep.
So it's kind of like, was he alluding to that? I don't know.
Well, and I think that's the bigger issue with this case and with the letters that the alumna from the girls' school brought up too, is that this is not the first time it's happened. And, you know, I'm curious, you know, on the local level, whether this merits further investigation into other cases that may have, you know, in the era of investing college campus and school campus sexual assault cases, whether there'll be further investigation. I can imagine if I were a parent who had a child at either one of those schools, I'd want to know what the heck was going on there.
This one's from Brucey. So much is hidden about Kavanaugh process. No other witnesses allowed. 90% of his records remain hidden, not allowing an FBI to further investigate the assault. A big, big rush to hide and confirm. The GOP hits the accelerator harder every day. And that's from Brucey. This one's from Mark. Thoughts on Albany being same old, given establishment victories in the primaries? I worry that A.G. James is compromised and that there will still not be enough progressives to make any real changes. Well, let's throw that over to former New York State Senator Terry Gibson.
No, I've certainly taken a detour here, but I would share your writer's concerns. I think that the primary elections that we just had pretty much show that the voters, at least on the 20% that decided to come out, favor the status quo, that they are scared to take a risk, that the ability for us to change the dynamics in our state legislature, in our state in general, are going to be difficult because the same people are going to be in charge, or people that were appointed by the people that are in charge are going to be in charge. So I share those concerns.
I think, you know, even though you saw for the Attorney General, that might be more of an issue, but at least in the state Senate, you saw 6 of the 8 IDC senators were knocked out. So I think in that respect, I mean, there will be change, but change in Albany is always, you know, at a glacial pace.
Right. Yeah. The IDC turnover was a big deal, very significant and very impressive. And it will have some very significant change to the process in terms of how legislation moves forward. But as long as we have an executive, meaning the governor, that does not seem to be overly motivated about bringing significant change to the state, bringing significant change to campaign finance reform, bringing significant change to election reform, then I don't think we can expect a lot of changes.
Remember, there's less political danger in less change. Now, Democrats will run the whole show, and so in future years, fingers can point. In the old days, you say, well, you still have the Republican-controlled Senate. We didn't get anything done, or what we did get done was not so great. Now, it's all on the Democrats.
Well, we still have a Republican-controlled Senate, and the primary election didn't change that, and the general election is where that will have to be changed.
But it will likely be changed in November.
Possibly.
Possibly. I would not say it's a given by any stretch of the imagination.
Should we put a fiver on it?
Well, I mean, I think there's still a lot of machinations involved in this, and we still have a few defectors that have not said that they're definitely not going to run because they're on this independent line, even though they lost the Democratic line. And we still have one Democrat that caucuses with the Republicans that just re-won his primary. So there's a lot of things involved, and I would not say it's a sure thing just yet.
Well, and what would you say will happen?
Well, I say that, you know, there's a 50-50 chance that the Democrats will take over.
What a cop-out.
But
I mean,
I think that's about as far as I'm willing to go on it.
Yeah, I think we'll probably have a split Senate.
Okay.
I think that, you know, the voters have the power to change this, but it will mean flipping some traditional Republican seats in the state Senate into Democratic hands. And if that doesn't happen in 2 or 3, 4 seats, then it's going to be difficult for things to change.
This one came in from Patrick. Panel, can anyone weigh in on why Supreme Court justices are given lifetime appointments? And if perhaps this should be seriously reconsidered, I think it should be changed. And that's from Patrick.
It's certainly something to discuss. I had recently saw a proposal where basically every president would receive 2 nominations. Basically, a Supreme Court justice would have an 18-year term. You know, certainly I think the way the framers looked at it was, you know, at that point when, you know, the Constitution was written in the 1780s, you saw, you know, people didn't live that long, you know. So now
Franklin lived a long time.
Well, yeah. He was the outlier. But now you have justices living to their 80s and their 90s. And so somebody who is in their, you know, late 40s, early 50s can serve for 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at multi-generational impacts here. So I think it's something definitely to consider what the ultimate right solution could be. That I'm not too sure on.
And that's something that also is echoed across people who are in judicial systems in terms of appointments. There tend to be longer term limits or less undefined terms, you know, whether it's a district attorney or a district court judge. So that's certainly something that's come into question across the board.
And in a number of states, there are retirement provisions. Obviously, yep. I think in New York State, it's 70.
This one is from Dana. Ford has had to move out of her house and hire security for her family due to death threats. This is a direct result of, we're whispering?
No.
Okay. Ford has had to move out of her house and hire security for her family due to death threats. This is a direct result of the GOP's continuing strategy of suppressing people's voices through their encouragement of violence. Anything less than a halt of the nomination process and a thorough investigation of these allegations is unacceptable. Why can't the GOP encourage the American public not to commit or threaten violence against their neighbors? This shouldn't be hard or partisan. And that is from Dana.
Yeah, I'm just watching the breaking news come on right now. We have Trump down in the Carolinas, but the press have gotten him to talk on a couple of issues. And one of the things that Trump, which has been kind of quiet on making any comment about Blasey Ford, but apparently he's saying that if she doesn't testify on Monday, that it would be, quote, unfortunate. And also, I think he does have a role in someone else can correct me if I'm wrong, in authorizing the FBI to do an investigation. I think that's something that does have to be run by the White House, if I'm not
mistaken. That's not likely to happen because he doesn't want to do anything that would encourage them to investigate him.
Right.
You have to remember, this is a president who is under numerous sexual assault accusations, investigations, both before he was a candidate, and since he's been president,
but he also seems to be picking and choosing now authorized, what's not authorized, what's classified, what's not classified.
He's being so untypically professional. He's being untypically quiet about this.
Yeah.
At least till now. Maybe that's changing.
This one is from Lynn. Says FBI is the key. For any candidate for a federal job must be investigated, and when a claim of wrongdoing comes up, then a reinvestigation is done, full stop. Consider, Kavanaugh talks to FBI from his performance in lying so far. Does he really want to do that? That is from Lynn. And we'll do two more letters here, and then we'll take a quick break. This one's from Adam. Ford had the truthfulness of her telling confirmed by a polygraph. Will Kavanaugh?
As I understand it, polygraphs are still considered to be a little on the iffy side.
It's still on the iffy side.
It just says that you believe what you're saying, but there's no scientific evidence to show that it actually shows that you're lying or not.
Okay, and let's see here. Let's take a break. It's the roundtable panel at WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, if you want to send a letter, and we'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC, Wednesday morning, 9:47. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Terry Gibson, Joe Bonilla, and Jen Smith on the panel. You as well at panel@WAMC.org. One more letter, and then we'll change gears here. This one is from a longtime listener, first-time contributor, AC, presumably not Alan. Can someone please comment on why so much has been made of the polygraph test taken by Ms. Wolf? Specifically, the test does not actually detect lies, only physiological responses. It's so funny. We were just talking about this in the break. They are subjectively interpreted responses. I do not believe that they are used very often in court. Terry, you just said that.
I don't think they're used in court at all. I don't think that you will find a case where the witnesses are put on a witness stand and have these things strapped to their arm. It's just not a part of our legal process where, you take an oath, you're expected to tell the truth, and it's all about providing evidence that proves that you either are or not telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. President Trump is flexing his executive power to declassify secret documents in the Russia investigation, a move he says will ensure that, quote, really bad things at the FBI are exposed. Critics of the move say the president has a clear conflict by trying to discredit an investigation in which he himself is a subject. The Justice Department says it has begun complying with that order, though it's not clear when the documents might be released. In a letter Tuesday to Director of National Intelligence Daniel Coats, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and FBI Director Christopher Wray, four top Democrats called Trump's action a brazen abuse of power.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm not going to argue with that. I think the idea that we're going to, right in the middle of one of the most historic investigations in this country has seen in a long time, disrupt it by beginning to release, the force the release of confidential documents, is very dangerous on many, many fronts. And I think it's all part of the public relations campaign that both the Republicans and Donald Trump continue to try to run, where they create chaos and distractions in an effort to keep the ball moving forward, hoping no one really notices what exactly is going on.
Well, I think definitely, building off Terry's point, it's definitely create this illusion and this distraction and the chaos, just because, there are so many, credible threats to our democracy coming out of this White House. And I think what I would probably say to this is that it's just, again, another attempt to get away from the actual real important issues that affect this country.
No one else has the ability to stop an investigation of themselves. No right. other American on the planet can say, I don't like the fact that you're investigating me. I'd like for you to disclose the documents and stop doing this.
Well, he's not stopping the investigation.
Well, making them release all these documents, you could disrupt it.
Them,
could
disrupt absolutely. It.
Yeah, and I think it's, again, it's about like what tone and precedence is this setting, and who can look into what's considered private. What if the president next decides like to go to audit other citizens and wants to go into their smartphones to see who else has been tweeting something against him, who else has been saying something against him, and in a time where you've got a guy like Kavanaugh who's saying like, no one is, I'm following the Constitution. I'm an upholder of the law. Like, who's upholding?
No one's above the law.
The laws in this case.
Right. And except for maybe the president.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the president's contention is those who asked for and received the FISA warrants were not upholding the law, and that they were using flawed data that they knew was flawed to get those FISA documents. And so is there any leg for him to stand on in releasing data that backs that assertion
he's
up?
He's also making an executive order here. And that's dangerous to the process of, entities like Congress doing their jobs, too. I think in terms of having this information out there, again, it's, we don't really know what's in there. So, once something is out there and it's leaked and anyone can use that. And I think that's what the danger is here. It just can't be good for any other systems that are meant to classify this information. There's a reason why it's classified.
It would be interesting to see what his personal lawyers and the White House lawyers are advising him to do on this, and how much of this they support and how much of it they are discouraging him doing, and how much of just him wanting to do what he wants to do. Because he clearly doesn't have the legal expertise himself to make these decisions,
evident, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, our email address here is panel@wamc.org, and I suspect many of our listeners may want to weigh in on that. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi said any decision by your offices to share this material with the president or his lawyers will violate longstanding Department of Justice policies. And I suppose if he's really a target of this investigation, he probably has no right to see the documents. Or maybe he does. This is the question.
Well, again, it's...
If there was other plaintiffs in other cases, no one would have that right.
No, nobody else would.
It just breaks all norms that we think of in our judicial system. And if the president can't abide by the same rules that all other American citizens do, then...
Well, American citizens have a right to see the evidence against them, right? That's discovery.
Right.
They do, but we're not at a point yet where the investigation is still ongoing, right? I mean, it's still in the process of happening. So the idea of sharing things in the middle of a investigation is very different than sharing them once someone has been put on the witness stand during a real trial.
Well, of course, all of these have to be vetted and declassified one by one, and various things have to be stricken.
And that's a timely process.
A very timely process in a
time where you're already asking, again, looking back to the Kavanaugh case, you're already asking the FBI to do or not do certain things, and you're also, this affects these already saturated agencies who are trying to do other work at the same time, too.
Yeah, right.
There's no other point to this other than to try to disrupt and bring the investigation to an end. That's the purpose. There's no other purpose than that. It's a political move to try to protect himself and to protect the party. What's in the documents and what they find is secondary to it. They must have some idea of what is in there, otherwise they wouldn't be taking this risk to ask them to be released in the first place.
Right. It's pretty cut and dry in that respect. I think that's all really comes down to it. Is the president trying to attempt not to be culpable to the American people?
And this is the roundtable panel. That was Joe Bonilla. We also have Terry Gibson and Jen Smith with us. You at panel@wamc.org. Only a couple minutes before the news break here. Leaders of North and South Korea announced a wide range of agreements today. Yesterday there. But the premier pledge on denuclearization contained a big condition, with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un stating he'd permanently dismantle his main nuclear complex only if the U.S. takes unspecified corresponding measures. Kim promised to accept international inspectors to monitor the closing of a key missile test site and launch pad and to visit South Korea soon. Both South Korean and North Korean leaders vowed to work together to try to host the Summer Olympics in 2032. Big news, not big news.
I think it's big news. I think from a public relations aspect, it's huge news. I mean, I want to see what happens here, but you have two countries that are clearly at least making some effort to try to resolve their differences, but there are two much bigger countries that stand to either gain or lose an enormous amount of what's decided upon. You have China, the world's largest country, and then you have the United States, the third largest country in the world, in the middle of all of this and around it, and the decisions that are made by North and South Korea will have enormous impacts on the U.S. and China.
But I think the other part of this is that we've seen this story before, where we've seen the Kims try to invite inspectors in, make this attempt to come into the world community, only to see it, pretty much fall apart at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Well, the president thought it was very exciting. He tweeted out that the meeting was very exciting. Lindsey Graham, not so much. He said he's concerned the visit would undermine efforts by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley to impose maximum pressure on the North, a schism in our own ruling party.
The U.S., in this particular case, the Trump administration, would like to take credit for bringing some type of resolution to the nuclear issue that we have in North Korea. And for them to work it on their own and take that power away from the U.S. is obviously very frustrating. But the Chinese have a lot at stake here, too. Mm-hmm. And they do not want to completely lose their loyal neighbor right next door. Mm-hmm. That's a strategic problem for them. And, of course, I know another story we're going to talk about is just the ongoing economic battle we have with China.
Mm-hmm.
This all ties into that.
Yeah,
and then you have Russia sitting out there on the sidelines just watching all of it, trying to sort of figure out how they can monopolize this.
So if what you say then is we read it as fact that China is really the key there with North Korea, is the threatened trade war or what we have done so far with tariffs a big inspiration, let's say, for China to finally say to North Korea, let's play ball?
It could be. I mean, a lot of the talk you hear about this tariff imposed situation between China and the U.S. is stating that what could happen is that our global economy becomes split in a way that it hasn't ever been split before, and that China just says, you know what, we're going to find a way to build an economy that doesn't even rely remotely on the U.S., and the U.S. is going to go find a way to build an economy that doesn't rely on China. And so new players like North and South Korea and other smaller countries have a lot of options that they didn't have in the past. And so this could be the beginning of that.
Well, I think the only clarification would be that I think we haven't seen this in at least 30, 40 years since the end of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And that's really what it comes down to, I think. Right. So we're looking at like the 2.0 version of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When Russia and the U.S. Kind of went through the same thing.
Correct.
And Russia
mm-hmm.
said, you know what, we're going to go find a way to survive without depending
on Eastern Bloc
with you.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right,
and
let's take a break here. The email address is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We have Terry Gibson, Jen Smith, and Joe Bonilla on the panel. We will take a break for news and be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable, Wednesday morning, 10:05. Ray in for Joe today. It's the Roundtable panel. Terry Gibson, Jen Smith, and Joe Bonilla with us at panel@wamc.org. Don't forget, The lockbox is open at WAMC.org. And right now, and only right now, you can get yourself a pair of tickets to see the Capitol Steps at the Egg Friday, November 9th, at a CD recording of the event. It's a WAMC exclusive. It's a $150 pledge or more for a pair of tickets. Just go to WAMC.org and feed the lockbox. Our on-air drive begins, they tell me, on Monday, October 15th. This letter came in. We'll read a couple of quick letters here and then move on. This is from Jill in Delmar. Blasey Ford's request for an FBI investigation argues for assessing evidence at witnesses free of partisanship. CNN reports that Anita Hill's allegations were investigated by the FBI, took 3 days. Grassley refuses Ford's request. Does that mean GOP wants to keep review of allegations biased? That is from Jill in Delmar. Anne writes, as I wrote in my letter on September 11th, Trump is throwing under the bus all the people at national security agencies that have kept us safe for the last 17 years. Why? More self-centered distractions? This is from Kathleen. Trump's release of documents pertaining into an investigation of himself is bad, but it's just one more of the same, more conspiracy theory tactics. Trump said he was wiretapped in Trump Tower and later complained about Christopher Steele's now mainly substantiated dossier. The list of dirty, distracted tricks goes on. Stay tuned. The American people are onto him. And that is from Kathleen. Anybody want to comment? Hearing nothing?
There's a lot there.
Yeah, there is a lot. And I guess I would say, the American people have seen this presidency now go on for close to almost 2 years now. But this is why it's incredibly important to come out to vote for the midterm elections. That's what I would probably say to every one of those writers.
Yeah, I agree. The easiest thing that we can all do to change the situation at every level of our government is to vote. And everything beyond that is just a lot harder.
And I will say, make a knowledgeable vote. Take the time to really understand it. Coming from the news world, gather your facts and
are you suggesting that some people do not make a knowledgeable vote?
I am.
China's premier appeals for free trade amid tariff battle. China's number two leader appealed today for support for free trade and promised to improve conditions for foreign companies following tit-for-tat U.S. and Chinese tariff hikes in a battle over Beijing's technology policy. Premier Li Keqiang comments add to Beijing's effort to portray itself as a defender of global trade in the face of complaints by Washington and other trading partners that China violates its market opening commitments. Also today, a foreign ministry spokesman accused Washington of lacking sincerity after it proposed negotiations and then raised tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese goods, but he gave no indication whether Beijing would take part in talks. Seems like insincerity is it's all around. I mean, the fact that China's trying to say they're the ones who are the defender of global trade it's pretty funny.
It's a little bit of a stretch for that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the real effects of all the tariffs that are happening are on the producers and the consumers. And so I think in this case, something's got to give. And whether that's going to really hit people involved. I mean, the latest round of tariffs are on things like mineral ores, liquefied natural gas, which are kind of bigger issues. Coffee, maybe not so much. Because there are other sources there, but I think, and again, I don't think the Beijing economy is becoming stressed because of that. And what will those effects be? Their currency really isn't holding that value that can accommodate what the response is to the given increasing tariffs from the U.S.
Well, it's interesting seeing this story that groups that are typically allies of the Trump administration, like the Chamber of Commerce, are very much against this tariff activity on the part of obviously both countries, but especially the United States. And their point is that this is going to drive the prices of products like washing machines and refrigerators up much higher, and in the long run, the American people are going to be paying a lot more, mm-hmm. and it's going to be very harmful to their industries that they represent.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's appliances, also mobile devices. But what you, I think the other effect is that you're now seeing these traditional Chinese companies, look at Foxconn, and now they're trying to build more plants in this country. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's going to ultimately happen, is that you'll start seeing a shift in terms of where manufacturing will take place. But I think that's the challenge, is that if we were to start to restart, you know, manufacturing in a large way, it's going to take at least a generation to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think the far-reaching impact is, again, this is a needless trade battle. It's something that, we need to figure out in a better way.
Well, to your point about starting over, take upstate New York just as one example. For how many decades have we been in the process of tearing down large factories, right. large industries, large complexes that used to make cars and all other types of things?
But for what reason? Because the Chinese labor was so cheap.
Right. Mm-hmm. But we have done that now. And so now to go back and start that over again, to me is a very appealing idea.
Yeah.
But we don't have the economic infrastructure, the educational infrastructure, and the political infrastructure in place to do that. And mm-hmm. so if that's what we're going to do, and I'm all for that, we need to get serious about electing people to government that want to do that, start changing our economic models, start making it possible for people to have affordable places to live, to get affordable education, to get the training they need to really begin to be real players in a global industry.
So then you would be for massive tax cuts for industries trying to restart?
I wouldn't go that far, but I think that, you know, we have to look at all the options and find a way to make it appealing to bring businesses back to the U.S.
Well, I think certainly on the education side, you know, trying to build up the trades and things along that side of things, because I think that's one area that this country and, you know, the state has not really done the best for in terms of really broadening out trade education in that mm-hmm. way. And I think that's really going to be the start of trying to basically restart manufacturing, especially up here in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, across the whole region, which includes Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut, all those regions, that's what we were kind of all founded on. And I think that's something that's going to be extremely challenging to go back to when, as someone who covers schools, we can't even have proper school buildings. We still have open classrooms from the 1960s. That's not a good place for children and young people who are expected to go into these high demand jobs that hadn't existed for the past couple decades to go back to. There's a lot of things at stake and that have to be planned, but at the same time, at the top, you don't have anyone advocating for that. It's a struggle just to have children who be insured, let alone put them in a pipeline to take on the next generation's responsibility of turning the economy around.
The on this story, the United Way released a study just the other day that pointed that New York State is on the verge of having 50% of its families not have enough income to just buy basic food, housing, transportation, clothing. And that's just one example of the vast inequality that we currently have in this state and in this country that makes it difficult to restart an economy that is manufacturing based in the way that we once knew it. We need to find a way to take those the wealth that we have in this country and invest it into the infrastructure that is needed to create manufacturing. And until that happens, which means there has to be a real change in mindset from the leaders of our government right now, especially the Republican Party that's refused to do this, that always fights against things like minimum wage increases, then it's going to be difficult to recreate what we used to have.
Mm-hmm. And the problem is that the manufacturing is not just putting, the manual parts of an automobile together. It's advanced manufacturing. And then you have a case like Global Foundries, right, that just had a bunch of layoffs. And they're connected with local colleges, supposed to be a pipeline for students to get training in manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, and then go and find jobs there. But we don't have the jobs infrastructure either. And that was supposed to be something that was supposed to be a sustainable plan.
I mean, one thing to Terry's point, this would take decades. A change like this, and it would require more than the will of the politicians. It would take the will of the people to – it'll be painful for 20, 30, however many years until that whole industrial base was rebuilt. And it won't even be the same. robotics have changed that. Who knows what jobs are there even then?
And then you have to take into account, again, the social issues that are raised by that United Way study. When it comes to income times, you have students who, you know, are working different jobs, not just for their own personal spending money, but to contribute to household income. You have all around our region, folks stressed out by addiction. There's a lot of generational issues that are happening too. It's a lot more. And again, if that's really the plan, you have to support it at the top. You have to be, you know, not distracted by some of the national issues that are happening and focus on, you know, how do you get things done.
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, our economy is so service-based right now, and as you have automations coming into play at every aspect, this could be the one bright spot that actually can actually create meaningful jobs in a meaningful way.
And you have some parts of the economy in some counties in this, Northeast region that are, look at the percentage of increase of nonprofits in the area, and that doesn't feed into the style of economy that we're talking about.
We've also done this before. It's not as if we haven't fought this battle before. Look at what FDR did, and look at the plans that he rolled out that really rebuilt our country. And some of those things did take decades to accomplish ultimately. So it can be done. And I think the real question here is, are we going to let the fact that it will take a long time stop us from doing it?
No, but in FDR's case, you had the depression. The pain was already there.
That's true.
This was, I'm going to try to fix it.
Right.
Another post-World War II, the pain had already been there, and the infrastructure was building because of the war. I think this is a different situation.
But I think, you know, the reality is that the pain is here now. The pain for many, many millions and millions of families in this country and in the state is here, but we are not acknowledging it. And there is just enough wealth that people are able to go about their lives and ignore it. But I think that is coming to an end very quickly. The pain is here. People are suffering.
Mm-hmm. They are.
And they're looking for, especially in upstate New York, especially from Albany on up, people are really looking for an option, and they're stuck. And it is government's job to step up and take care of the people. And that's going to require some real sacrifices on the part of the wealthy and on the part of the corporations that have the financial resources to come back to the United States and make an investment in their country. Mm-hmm.
Terry Gibson is here. Joe Bonilla is here, and Jen Smith on the panel. And you at home via panel at WAMC.org. That's the email address, panel@WAMC.org. Facebook is allowing job ads on its platform that exclude women, according to the American Civil Liberties Union. In a complaint filed Tuesday with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the ACLU lists 10 employers that it claims have placed ads on Facebook that violate federal and state discrimination laws. Changes Facebook made to its ad system this year to prevent discrimination based on race, ethnicity, religion, and other characteristics did not extend to gender, the group said. Facebook responded quickly, saying there's no place for discrimination on its platform. The ACLU and the Communications Workers of America Labor Union say the ads target potential job applicants based on gender. This includes women as well as people who do not identify as either men or women. The complaint was filed on behalf of three women living in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Illinois who alleged they were not shown ads for jobs traditionally male-dominated fields, even though they appeared qualified for these positions. Have you guys seen this article?
Yeah, and it dovetails off of another case that popped up last year relative to age discrimination and federal age discrimination laws. There's questions of whether people within a certain age bracket were excluded from seeing job opportunities. So this is again, another angle at looking at how Facebook provides different infrastructure, different algorithms that can be used by different companies that they work with to include or exclude certain cohorts and demographics.
Well, it's all behavioral based. It's also location based as well. Mm-hmm. As somebody who, you know, we commit a number of dollars online to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, everything, you know, we can pinpoint who we want to target. And, you know, whether it's for job listings or it's for, you know, any sort of event or initiative or campaign that we're working on. The problem with this, though, is that as Facebook has now become a greater player in the job market, you know, competing against Craigslist and Monster and things like that, this is an issue that they have to be able to rectify. It's one thing to target, you know, certain, you know, demographics for advertising, but you can't apply the same thing for jobs.
Well, you know, we have to remember, like as you mentioned, Facebook is a for-profit corporation. Their main objective is not to make sure that we're all receiving a service that we're all happy with. Their main objective is to make a profit. And so they're always testing out different ways to do this. And it's all that profit is driven by ad revenue. And so the thing that gets the most clicks is the thing that gets them the most profit. And that's how these types of things come about. And yes, it's unfair and it needs to be dealt with. And it is a real danger to our entire communication system in America that this company and companies like it, including Google, have become such monopolies in terms of our access to information, and the controls that they have on that are kind of scary. And I think that there does need to be some serious investigation into them and Google and other companies like them. And some regulations, I think, are forthcoming to deal
with this. What regulations would you recommend, Terry Gibson?
Well, I think that, you know, it's much in the way that we dealt with the early telephone systems, where when we originally had just one telephone system that had command of our entire communication system, we began to say, look, there has to be competition here. You have to let other people come in and play in this field. And there are certain things that you have to provide regardless of how you go about operating. It can, you know, yes, you can make a profit, but you've got to meet certain criteria to do it.
So in that same respect, would you suggest or at least recommend that like organizations like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram or even Google should come under the auspices of, you know, regulation under the PSC?
I think it's very possible that we should certainly consider that. Right now, they're really just free-running corporations that are commanding every moment of our lives without any real government oversight anywhere.
Well, isn't that part of the problem, though? So beyond just the infrastructure, right, these are all platforms just to publish job opportunities. Mm. Isn't the bigger onus on the employers themselves to say, what are we doing to provide to really truly exercise equal opportunity practices? You know, you have a choice as an employer to do recruiting. You know, if that's the problem. I think there isn't a great amount of effort happening nationwide by employers to specifically train and recruit people from different backgrounds to really show the willingness to have different people, whether it's by gender, by race, by demographic, and bring them up into the table. I mean, some companies are successful at having, you know, programs where it starts in college, where you reach out to different groups, you have an internship pathway program or a co-op, and then you pull them into agencies. So you build in that diverse workforce. But here again, you know, it's just you choose to engage with a platform that could have these allegedly discriminatory methods.
Well, you know, I mean, we're fortunate to have groups like the ACLU that make it their job to go around and try to hold these organizations accountable. There's always been ways to discriminate in the hiring process, whether it's just running an ad in a newspaper, right. Whether it's doing it on Facebook, the whole interview process itself. I mean, we know there still continues to be great discrimination in the employment
process.
And
the organizations need to hold themselves accountable.
Well, that's what it comes down to. But I think at the same time, you know, these platforms need to do their job and at least not allow this to happen.
Yeah.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org, and we'll read one more here before we wrap up. This one came in from Dan. It's been a while since I've heard anything about Trump's tax returns. Perhaps the tax audit, he said, prevented him from releasing his returns is over. Was there ever an audit? Does it even matter? Why would that prevent him from releasing his returns? In any event, has Mueller been able to look at these returns, or is that something that has been negotiated with the White House? Anybody know anything about that?
Well, that's a good question. I think not knowing the answer to that and it not being in the news lately is a result of what I would consider to be a fairly successful strategy on the Trump administration part to keep so much chaos going on that the American people can never focus on one thing from one second to the next.
We know more about his spurious health exam than we do about his taxes.
And it was a spurious health exam? He was in fine shape.
He was, a svelte 239.
All right, fine. Joe Bonilla, thank you for being with us today. Terry Gibson, thank you. And Jen Smith, thank you very much. Don't forget, now this is exciting, the lockbox is open at wamc.org. You want to go see Capitol Steps and yuck it up and laugh and have a good time? They will be at the Egg November 9th at 7:30 p.m., a WAMC event. A pledge of $150 or more at WAMC.org will get you a pair of tickets, $100 for a single ticket, and it is a WAMC exclusive event. You will get a CD recording of that. All you got to do is go to WAMC.org. Jen Smith, just in the last 20 seconds,
yes,
tell me about the robbery. That's just big news.
There's been a couple in the Berkshires, but right now they appear to be unrelated, but it's definitely raising some public safety concerns. Obviously, concern if you're a bank employee,
yes,
in the region. You know, is this a trend, or are these isolated incidents, and why? So that's what's being investigated.
And we can find out more
right
in the Berkshire Eagle?
You betcha, BerkshireEagle.com.
Well, thank you very much for being here. And Terry Gibson, thank you. Joe Bonilla, thank you. And thank you for listening to that. Don't go anywhere. There's another half of the roundtable ahead. You're listening to WAMC.